Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Theodore Roosevelt shape the country and the world after he left the White House? Having served out the remainder of William McKinley's term and then won the presidency in his own right in 1904, Roosevelt emerged from his service the youngest former president in U.S. history. He wasted no time seeking a change of scenery from Washington, but was hardly ready to retire. Roosevelt remained physically active and avidly political. He quickly grew disillusioned with his hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft, and mounted a primary challenge to the incumbent that ended with Roosevelt forming a brand new party to take him on in the general election. Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris has been studying and writing about TR for decades. His new book about the final decade of the president's life and the third and final volume of a trilogy is called Colonel Roosevelt. Edmund Morris will be in town tomorrow to speak at the Belo Mansion for the National Center for Policy Analysis at noon. He will also speak tomorrow night at 6:30 at the French Room in the Adolphus Hotel for the Authors at the Adolphus French Room series. Edmund, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
We should start with this. Roosevelt, there was no law that said he couldn't run for a second full term or a third term in office, but it was custom that dictated that he step down. Is that correct?
That's right, but he felt there had been a precedent established by George Washington that two terms were enough for any man, no matter how much power became him. So he declined a third term in 1908, which he could have had on a silver platter if he'd wanted it.
Was
and,
it hard? Excuse me. Go
regretted
ahead.
It the moment he gave it up and ran again in 1912.
Now, William Howard Taft was the candidate that Roosevelt himself had favored to take over after he left. What sort of relationship did they have before Roosevelt left the White House?
It was buddy buddy, master and servant. The president loved William Howard Taft because Taft was a genial, portly, accommodating person. The ideal subservient. But after he had elevated Taft to be his successor, like many powerful men handing over power, he began to regret the fact that the power he'd handed over was not being used and capitalized on as he'd hoped to be. And he therefore began to regret giving it over and wanting it back again.
What sort of contact did he have with Taft in those early months and years after Taft took over the White House?
None whatsoever. 3 weeks after leaving the White House in a snowstorm, T.R. was sitting on the cowcatcher of a locomotive going up from Mombasa up into the highlands of Kenya to begin this marathon, year-long safari in the East African wilderness. So during the course of that year, even more than a year, lasting through to the spring of 1910, he had virtually no contact whatsoever with news from the United States.
Was that something, do you think, that he needed so that he would, do you think he was trying in a way to sort of grieve the fact that he was no longer president of the United States?
Oh, no, no. Initially, he was quite happy to hand over power. And he really only became disillusioned with Taft when he came down the Nile in the spring of 1910 and found out that Taft was not a very efficient or popular president and was beginning to undo some of the progressive legislation that TR had accomplished during his own term.
Now, Roosevelt certainly adored shooting animals for its own sake, but in fact, on this safari, he was collecting museum specimens. Is that right?
Yes, it was an official expedition for the Smithsonian. He was collecting giant specimens. In fact, I ran into a guy the other day who just told me that some of the crates from that expedition have yet to be opened. He collected a gigantic quantity of large and small specimens, including botanical specimens. But nevertheless, although it was scientific in its purpose, you're quite correct in saying that he did relish killing. And it's an aspect of him that I've never quite been able to understand, because this was a man who loved animals with all his soul.
It was almost sort of his affection for them that made him want to preserve them, do you think?
Yes, we're veering into awkward territory here, the relationship of love and death in hunting. All really passionate hunters, serious hunters, will tell you that they love the animals they kill, and in killing them, they obtain some sort of knowledge of them, which is beyond the comprehension of people like me. I've never understood why the act of killing should be an act of love, but for them it was.
Was he, Edmund, a picky hunter? Did he want only the biggest and the best?
Well, he was required to find the biggest and the best if he could for the purposes of the museum. But of course, the biggest and best being the most dangerous, that also appealed to him in a visceral sense. And it was literally within 10 days of his safari commencing that he was facing lions. Standing in the path of an oncoming lion is something that, I can assure you, concentrates the mind wonderfully. So there's no question that he was testing his courage and his manhood, as he called it, and his virility in an age-old contest of man and beast.
It's so hard to imagine a former president today being allowed to do anything remotely so dangerous.
Well, even in his time, it was... He did receive quite a lot of counsel from preservationists and conservationists that what he was doing would very likely be seen as unseemly. Mm-hmm. After all, he'd made an image for himself as the great nature lover and the great conservationist president. And the killing that he subsequently indulged sickened even some of his best friends. Cecil Spring Rice, for example, the British ambassador to London, to Washington, who was an old friend of T.R.'s, said when he read T.R.'s account of this safari in African Game Trails, the book he published when he got back, Cecil Spring Rice said it was sickening. It read like the diary of a butcher.
You know, his physical courage is especially notable given the fact that he had been quite fragile in his youth and, in fact, had been advised to stay away from pretty much every sort of activity by which he would later define his life.
That's quite true. He was told when he graduated from Harvard that his heart was not good, that his constitution was not strong, and that he should lead a sedentary scholarly life. His reaction was, he said, "Doctor, I'm going to do everything you advise me not to. I'm going to climb mountains. I'm going to live a vigorous physical life. I'm going to hunt large animals. And I'm going to live up to the hilt until I'm 60, and then I will die." He kept that promise almost to the letter. He died at the age of 60 in 1919.
So he didn't hesitate to go on these extended trips, but he certainly missed his wife and wrote her these very romantic letters. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, he was a lover. He was a very large man who encompassed many aspects. Unlike many presidents, he cared passionately for his children, and he passionately loved his wife. The story of his marriage to Edith Kermit Roosevelt is one of the great love stories in American history. They were childhood sweethearts. They used to sit reading books together on the steps of the brownstone where he was born in New York City when they were both 5, 6, 7 years old. Mm-hmm. Although he married another woman, a beautiful young Boston girl that he met when he was at college, that marriage was short-lived. She died after only 4 years of marriage. And he then reverted to his youthful relationship with Edith and had this long and fabulously successful marriage that ended when he died in 1919, but she went on till 1948.
You mentioned that he was advised to lead this very scholarly life. In fact, that was also a huge element of his personality that we might forget today because we think of this bold, brash figure. In fact, he wrote 40 books?
40 books, 150,000 letters, some of which are quite magnificent literature, full of overwhelmingly rich and humorous personality that just emanates from every line of the prose. And he was a bona fide intellectual, as you've implied, and as I discovered, rather to my surprise, writing this third book, I'd always known that his intellect was broad, that he had an extraordinary command of foreign cultures. He'd lived abroad and traveled widely and was quite fluent in French and German as well as Italian. He read on average a book a day. So he was a man of very broad knowledge, extraordinarily broad knowledge. But it wasn't until I began work on this last book describing some of the literary and scientific essays that he wrote during his years out of power, that I realized his intellect was deep as well as wide. He had a genuinely philosophical turn of mind and an inquiring mind that led him in all sorts of different directions. So his literary output after leaving the White House is something quite impressive.
One of the things that he explored in some of his writing was the perceived conflict between religion and science. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm rather glad you brought that up, because I was enormously struck by a long cerebral essay he wrote in 1911 called The Search for Truth in a Reverent Spirit. And it was a discussion of the conflicting, the developing conflict between evolutionary science and orthodox religion. The Catholic Church in 1911 was going through a very conservative phase, and of course science was becoming more and more sophisticated as evolutionary teaching spread around the world. So T.R. wrote this magnificent survey of current thought, scientific thought and religious thought, synthesizing all sorts of different points of view, and produced what I think is his single most impressive intellectual essay, to which I gave quite a lot of space in this book.
And one of his arguments, I'm vastly oversimplifying it here, was that anyone who had no problem accepting the fact that the world wasn't flat ought to have no problem accepting the existence of evolution.
Yes, it's quite true. What he, in essence, said was more or less what Pope John Paul II said in his great encyclical, written about 90 years later at the end of the last century, Fides et Ratio, an encyclical on the conflict between faith and reason. And what both of these men said, T.R. in his time and the Pope in his, was that the respective communities of scientists and religionists must understand that they had much to learn from each other. Scientists had to, and in fact frequently did, accept that faith is a large part of scientific research, the acceptance of the abnormal and the unexpected and the inexplicable. And theologians, too, had to accept that science had much to teach the believers in Orthodox religion, and that the two sides of the question had to communicate with each other and sympathize with each other, otherwise civilization would not progress.
How did his intellectual side play out? You write about the fact that he gave these very long, sometimes overbearing speeches. Were they intellectual in nature, or were they more preachy in nature?
Most of his political speeches were preachy. Mm-hmm. He always pitched his rhetoric to the level of his audiences. And he understood that a man campaigning for presidential power, or as president trying to manipulate the electorate to accept his policies, that such a man had to speak in platitudes, in simplicities, in language that everybody could understand, and that he must reiterate certain basic truths over and over and over again, drumming it into the skull of the American people. To an extent, you could say he was patronizing, but he certainly understood that a president has to express himself in language the people can understand.
Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris is my guest. His newest book is called Colonel Roosevelt. He'll be in town to speak tomorrow at the Belo Mansion and at the Adolphus Hotel. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris. His new book is called Colonel Roosevelt. He'll be in town tomorrow to speak at two different events, one at noon at the Below Mansion for the National Center for Policy Analysis, another at 6:30 at the Adolphus as part of the Adolphus French Room series. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Edmund, TR finished his safari trip with what amounted to an extended tour of Europe and of North Africa. Can you talk about what made him so particularly popular overseas?
Well, to his surprise, he found that this year that he'd spent in Africa, completely out of touch with the outside world, had made him more famous when he came out of it than he had been before. It was the drama of suddenly dropping out of history, as it were. He'd been a very flamboyant president, the first international president we've had, paid great attention to by foreign nations, so much so that as president he was asked to mediate the Russo-Japanese War. Mm-hmm. It's the first time the only time any of our presidents has ever been asked to mediate a foreign war. So he's an international figure who suddenly vanished. And for a total year, he was gone. So it was the shock of his disappearance and the drama of his reappearance when he came down the Nile in the spring of 1910 that stamped him on the attention of the world, and he found himself greeted in Khartoum by a phalanx of newspaper correspondents from all around the world wanting him to comment on the current world situation, and was he going to come back to the United States and run again for the presidency, and questions like that. And his celebrity was underlined by the fact that there was also present in Khartoum emissaries bringing an invitation from all the crowned heads of Europe, the heads of all the great states, wanting him to embark on a grand tour and to stay in their palaces and lecture their parliaments and their universities and see their armies and exercise. And in effect, tour the continent as though he was still a head of state himself.
How evident? Continue. I'm sorry.
So that's indeed what he found himself embarking on, this grand tour of Europe, in the course of which he met all the heads of state, practically all the heads of state, who in a few short years would be at war with one another.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How evident was it that, in fact, World War I might be on the horizon?
What evidence was there?
Yeah, to him, specifically.
Oh, well, there's plenty of evidence in the sense that all these potentates themselves knew that some great calamity was coming. There was a general consciousness amongst the leaders of the old world that Germany's rise to world power was going to have to be taken into account. This great military behemoth that was developing in the heart of Europe. But TR himself saw it with his own eyes, having seen the French army exercising and having spoken to all these heads of state. He ended up in Germany in May of 1910 on horseback, sitting with the Kaiser, looking out over the field of Döberitz and seeing sweeping past him wave after wave after wave of German military regiments. The German military machine, which was the central strategic phenomenon of the early 20th century. And after he'd seen this frightening exhibition of mechanized power, he said to his wife that night, "We're in for it," meaning civilization, Western civilization, is going to have to deal with the threat of German militarism within a very short time.
So let's talk about 1912. Roosevelt ran first for the Republican nomination against William Howard Taft, was ultimately unsuccessful in that. First off, can you tell us a little bit about the primary election process as it existed in this country a century ago?
The primary election process was becoming the law of the land, or at least the custom of the land, but it still extended only to about half of the states. In other words, 50% of the American states still chose their delegates to conventions and their senatorial office holders by means of the party. So the contest that developed for the Republican nomination in 1912, in which TR competed for the nomination, boiled down to the Orthodox Party in the Orthodox states supporting President Taft and all the primary states voting overwhelmingly for TR.
Which ultimately was not enough to give him the Republican nomination. Who backed him in the Bull Moose Party?
Well, he had accumulated an enormous constituency of progressives, with a small p, mm-hmm. progressive Republicans, who had begun to cluster around him and follow his ideology when he was in his second term as president. And these men and women had become so numerous by 1912 that they more or less compelled him to bolt the Republican Party when he was denied the nomination and form the Progressive Party, or Bull Moose Party, that went on to fight the election against President Taft, the Republican, and Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat.
So, fatefully, T.R. was shot point blank in the chest by a saloon keeper at a campaign event, not only managed to deliver the speech as intended, but in fact turned the whole event into an example of his extraordinary vigor. Can you tell us that story, please?
I'd be happy to. It's an example of the many stories that cluster around his life, all these theatrical episodes that just seem to come so naturally to him. And of course, that makes him a biographer's dream.
Sure.
Everybody likes to write about adventurous narratives. So this particular drama occurred in the middle of October 1912 when he was at the climax of his campaign and was due to address a large meeting in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after dinner. He came down from dinner, emerged from his hotel, surrounded by a few Secret Service people and his aides, and stepped into the limousine which was waiting to take him to the Milwaukee Auditorium. And there was a crowd clustering around the limo in the street who cheered him as he climbed into the car and took his seat. It was an open limousine. And as they cheered him, he responded by taking off his hat and waving at them. A rather uncanny similarity to Ronald Reagan coming out of a hotel in March 1981 and also waving at a small crowd and also getting a bullet in the chest, because that's what happened at this moment. As T.R. waved, a small, blonde, pudgy little man stepped out and shot him point blank in the chest. The bullet passed through his thick overcoat, through his jacket, through his vest pocket, which fortunately had his speech, a thick 50-page manuscript doubled over, and his steel spectacle case, and through his shirt and into his chest and smacked into a rib. And if it hadn't been for all these impedimenta, the bullet was straight on a course for his heart, and he would have been dead before he sat down.
And in fact, it lodged 3 inches into his chest.
That's right, and he carried it in his chest for the rest of his life. And of course he should have gone straight to the hospital because he was beginning to bleed. But being melodramatic as well as dramatic, he insisted on being taken to the auditorium. One of his aides stepped out and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Roosevelt has been shot, but he's in good shape to talk to you, and he wants to talk to you." So T.R. marched onto the stage with blood spreading all over his shirt front, and you can imagine the reaction of the audience. So he shouted at them in his high-pitched voice, "It takes more than that to kill a bull moose," and proceeded to speak for the next 90 minutes, tottering on his feet. And only then, when he was through with the speech, did he allow his aides to take him to hospital.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris, author of the new book Colonel Roosevelt. Let's go to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Well, a quick question from Mr. Morris would be, was it ever figured out what the saloon keeper had against the Bull Moose people? But the reason I called was to get back to earlier the conclusion that based on President Roosevelt's exploits in Africa, one has to conclude that he was a butcher. Yet President Roosevelt, he's one of the four faces on Mount Rushmore. He's regarded as one of the better ones. And maybe that was an act of, fealty by the sculptor of Mount Rushmore to put him up there, based on who gave him the commission to do it. I'm not sure, but I like to think he's up there because of his acts, of his conservation acts, primarily his establishment of the federally protected lands in the West in the National Forest Service.
Yes. Well, everything you say is true. We have to understand we're talking about an enormous personality here, and men of his dimensions are fundamentally paradoxical. He was, as you say, a great pioneer conservationist. He was, as you say, a mighty hunter. He loved to kill. And all these paradoxes are contained in his polygonal personality. When you ask about the motivations of John Schrank, the assassin, the would-be assassin, they are also paradoxical because although Schrank fit the traditional paranoid profile of presidential assassins, he was short and solitary and prone to delusions, and had this fixation that God was driving him on to punish Theodore Roosevelt for running for a third term. There was nevertheless in his paranoia a certain amount of sense, or at least of conscience, because he believed, Schrank did, that the two-term tradition should be preserved, and that T.R. had committed the fatal insolence by campaigning for a third term.
So we know that he was able to actually gain more votes than Taft, William Howard Taft, in the general election, but of course the White House went to Woodrow Wilson. Did Roosevelt regret that his presence in the election effectively allowed a Democrat to win the White House?
Oh, yes, he began to regret. In fact, he regretted it very much. But we should understand that he knew from the very moment that he began to run for the presidency in 1912 that he was doing so reluctantly, and he knew there was no way he could win. The Republican Party was heading for defeat in 1912. That was universally perceived. They'd been in power too long, and the Democratic Party had become too strong. So T.R.'s campaign, you could say, was quixotic. As it was, he managed to win many more votes than President Taft and ran second, but merely by running, he made it inevitable that Woodrow Wilson would be elected.
Of course, Wilson was reelected in 1916, largely on the fact that he had kept the United States out of the First World War, which I guess infuriated Roosevelt.
It did, because by then it was quite obvious, to Roosevelt at least, that the United States was morally compelled to get into that war, if only for reasons of its own dignity. The Lusitania had been sunk, this great ocean liner had been sunk in May of 1915 on its way across the Atlantic with many American lives lost, had been sunk by a German submarine. So as far as T.R. was concerned, that was an act of war against a neutral nation. And he was also desolate in his soul over the destruction of the University of Louvain by the Germans at the end of 1914, when they rolled across Belgium and deliberately destroyed the greatest medieval library in Europe and went on to destroy the Cathedral of Reims. So these acts of barbarity against civilization, plus the hostility that Germany showed toward the United States, were, as far as he was concerned, reason enough for the United States to get involved in the war. And of course, that's why he despised Woodrow Wilson, for being, in Wilson's own phrase, too proud to fight.
And this wasn't just talk for Roosevelt. Time and time again, he volunteered to be called up for military service.
Yes, he had this romantic notion that war was glorious, and to die in war was the finest thing a man can do if he was dying for principles. So he rather pathetically begged Wilson over and over again in 1916 and 17 to be allowed to go to Europe to lead a division of American volunteers. Particularly after the United States did enter the war in May of 1917. He went to the White House and begged Wilson to be allowed to do this. And Wilson, quite justly, in my opinion, denied him the privilege, saying that war had changed radically since T.R. had been young and had fought in Cuba in the Spanish-American War. It was no longer a matter of cavalry charges and sword-waving and individual courage. It had become brutal and mechanized and universal and could only be fought by professional armies. So he denied T.R. that wish, and T.R.'s last years were melancholy. And he put a rather distressing amount of faith in his four sons to go to Europe and fight on the Western Front in his stead and perhaps die for him, which in fact one of them did.
His son Kermit, that he was very close to.
Yeah, he was very close to Kermit, but the son who was most like himself and the son who was the youngest and the brightest, Quentin, was, tragically enough, the one who had to die. He was a fighter pilot in July of 1918 and was shot down by a German fighter plane after a dogfight. And that single tragedy was so devastating to T.R. that his own death a few months later was more or less foreordained.
He essentially never got over it.
No, no. He died of what seems to have been a pulmonary embolism, but it's very probable that his heart gave out. And I think you could quite metaphorically say he died of a broken heart.
My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris. His new book is called Colonel Roosevelt. He's in town. He will be in town to speak tomorrow at two events, one at noon at the Belo Mansion for the National Center for Policy Analysis. Then at 6:30, he will appear at the French Room at the Adolphus Hotel for the Authors at the Adolphus French Room series. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris. His new book is called Colonel Roosevelt. You can go to the Think page of KERA.org to find information about his two appearances in Dallas tomorrow. To join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Greg in Dallas. Hello, Greg.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a question about the number of letters that Teddy Roosevelt wrote. I think I heard your guest say 150,000, and that seems almost unimaginable, because if you do simple math, you would see that let's assume that he started writing letters at the young age of 15 and wrote letters until he died at 60, that's 45 years of letter writing. He would have had to have written 9 letters every day of his life for 45 years, and that's just... Maybe I misunderstood your guest, or that's... Explain to me how he could write that many letters and who he wrote them to.
What about that, Edmund?
Well, I'm afraid the statistic is pretty accurate. He started writing letters rather earlier, at age 10, and he continued to write letters until he was on his deathbed. He himself estimated that he'd written 150,000 letters toward the end of his life, and the Library of Congress, which has the main Roosevelt archive, has confirmed that is the total. About 1/10 of them were published in the 1950s in 8 great fat volumes, and you'll see in the introduction to that sequence the figure of 150,000 authenticated by the editors who compiled the volumes.
In the writing that he published about his time in the White House, what does he reveal about himself, and is there anything that he leaves out that you thought was interesting as an omission?
No. He was a resolutely honest man, surprisingly honest. He certainly had a high, a tremendous ego. So the letters express this force of self-certainty. Many of them were written deliberately for posterity. Whenever he did anything particularly important or spectacular, he could be quite sure he'd write a posterity letter afterwards. But what these letters also illustrate is an aspect of him we've not touched on in this program yet, and aspect of him that has made my 30 years of writing about him and thinking about him pleasurable. And that is that he was so funny. In his private person, and in many of his letters, he was a brilliant comedian. He had people around him in stitches of laughter with his everyday conversation. He was a great raconteur. And when, for example, he embarked on that great grand tour of Europe and began to tell stories about it afterwards, stories of all his dealings with the kings and emperors who entertained him, the stories were so funny that his friends begged him to write a posterity letter about the grand tour, which he proceeded to do. He wrote two letters, so long that they could be published as small books in themselves. And they're so funny that when I was writing about it myself, I was almost falling out of my chair with laughter. So this is a large aspect of him that makes Theodore Roosevelt such an attractive biographical subject. In addition to all his intellectual worth and his political validity, he was fun.
Do you feel like your relationship to him has changed over the years you've been writing about him?
Not much. I became aware of him as a schoolboy in Kenya, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. I saw a photograph of him when I was 10 years old, in his safari guise with a helmet on and his mustache and his teeth. I don't know what it was about that picture, but to me, he just looked like fun, to use that same word I've just used, and the sort of man I'd like to spend time with as a boy. So when, as an adult, I came back to him and began to write about him in 1975, and as a much older man now, having finished writing about him, I don't think my attitude has changed much. He has been consistently entertaining. And although there are aspects of him that I find unattractive, the hunting, for example, and the political preachiness, which I often find boring, despite these negative aspects, he was a superb person and a delight to write about.
You were also the official biographer for Ronald Reagan, and I wonder if you can talk just for a minute about how the experience differs when you're writing about a subject, a president, that you can meet and interview as compared with one who exists only in the historical record.
Yes, it's a question I have been asked quite often, and I can understand why, because it's fundamental. Is it easier to write about a live president or a dead one? Well, naturally, there are problems either way. There are certain aspects of Theodore Roosevelt's presidency, for example, the great coal strike of 1902, when he presided over an enormously dramatic meeting to mediate that strike, where there just are no records of that historic meeting. So there's nothing a biographer can do but just write around it. Some things just vanish into the depths of history. But when you're dealing with a live president, as I did with Reagan, one has to deal with the fact that everybody around him or connected with him is aware of the fact that the president is alive and in power, and they therefore become cagey or difficult or impossible to interview. You have to deal with living sensibilities, whereas when a man is dead, that ceases to be much of a problem. On the other hand, you have the advantage of being able to have a physical knowledge of your subject, as Boswell did of Johnson. And in the case of Theodore Roosevelt, I never had that luxury. So in each case, the form presents problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is the author of a new book called Colonel Roosevelt, Edmund Morris. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Roosevelt also lived to see the great Colorado coal strike of 1913-14 and the Ludlow Massacre, and I've always wondered what his attitude was towards labor, organized labor at that time, and if he ever commented on the brutality of the Ludlow Massacre.
Thanks for your call.
I'm not aware of any direct commentary, but I certainly know that his labor proposals as the progressive candidate in 1912, his proposals for employee liability insurance and restrictions on child labor and many other aspects of labor policy were regarded as radical for their time. Radical, certainly, for a Republican conservative, as he used to be. And many of his calls for reform in the Progressive Party platform 1912 was so far to the left that he was dismissed as a socialist by many of his old conservative buddies, and those reforms were not fully enacted until the time of FDR.
What accounts for that commitment that he had, having been raised in a family of great privilege, that commitment that he had to the poor and to the powerless?
He was not, believe it or not, a particularly compassionate man. He had a strong sense of social justice, but you could not ever describe him in the same terms as his own father, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., who had a huge well of compassion for the poor and the sick and the lame and the unfortunate. T.R. believed in strong government, which should be which should make allowances for the unfortunate, but I don't think his heart ever ached for the poor. He was a patrician concerned with large abstract matters of social justice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ron in Cedar Hill. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I really appreciate hearing you talk. It's almost as if you knew him personally. I have two questions. One is it true that T.R.'s father did not serve in the Civil War because he paid someone else to take his place, and that T.R. Was ashamed of that? And did that affect him, that he have to try to make up for the shortcomings of his father? And did that lead to a sense of invincibility, that he would charge up a hill in Cuba, or think that his sons could fight in World War I and not get shot? And then Quinton's death just kind of shattered that. Is that true?
Well, it's a very common speculation, and with respect, I find it a little simplistic. T.R. never himself specifically said that he became as ardent a soldier and an apostle of the strenuous life because of his father's failure to serve in the Civil War. The fact was that his father really could not have by any means done that. Theodore Roosevelt's father was a Yankee married to a quintessential Southern woman. They lived in New York, but this T.R.'s own mother was born and bred on a Southern plantation, and she was an ardent pro-Confederate throughout the length of the war. So T.R. Sr. being married to her could not effectively enlist in the Union Army and go and fight against her brothers. So he compensated for that by becoming a non-military participant in the war and worked extensively with President Lincoln in going around to the troops and acting as a sort of a commissioner of pensions. I don't think it bothered T.R. particularly, but it is a theory people come out with from time to time on pretty slender evidence.
We have an email here from Jimmy in Benbrook who wants to know whether Theodore Roosevelt and Winston Churchill ever met or conversed. He writes, they seem to have had so many similarities, stamina, breadth of intellectual interest, etc.
Yes, they did indeed meet, and the story of their contrary personalities and their relationship is a deliciously interesting one, which I went into in a lengthy footnote in Colonel Roosevelt. It didn't quite fit in the main text proper, but I went through the entire length of their relationship, which was that of two prima donnas of very similar character, both statesmen of literary inclinations, both in their youth participated in historic cavalry charges. They did meet when Churchill came to the United States in 1900 and T.R. was governor of New York. Churchill went up to Albany to stay with the Roosevelts, and T.R. took an instant dislike of him because on coming down for dinner that night, he noticed that Churchill continued to sit in his chair, smoking his cigar and drinking his whiskey, when women came into the room. And that, to Theodore Roosevelt, was the act of a person who was not a gentleman. He always thought that Churchill was not gentlemanly and was slightly vulgar to boot. But I really think the real reason for his distaste for Churchill was that they just had two giant egos, and egos of that size always clash.
You can't have two in the same room simultaneously.
No. Although Churchill did try again to see him when he'd embarked on his grand tour of Europe at the time of King Edward's funeral. And if this gentleman is interested in that story, he'll read about it in the footnote that I have included in my book.
What do you do when you have devoted so much of your career to writing? And I know there have been breaks in between, but to writing about one person, and then you're finished. You finish the last word of the final book. What do you do?
Well, I think I'm unlike many biographers in that I do, I'm never obsessed with my subjects, and I've always done a different book after each of the big volumes on T.R.
Mm-hmm.
After my first volume on his pre-presidential life, I wrote him that biography of Ronald Reagan, Dutch, which took me 14 years to write. And then I went back to Theodore Roosevelt's presidency and wrote Theodore Rex. And after I was through with that, I wrote a biography of Beethoven. And then I went back and wrote the third volume, Colonel Roosevelt, which I've just finished. So I've detached myself from him after each volume. And when I came to the end of the third book, much as I've enjoyed this marathon biographical trek, I felt completely dispassionate and very happy to move on to something else.
I suppose it keeps you sane, because if you had been obsessed with your subject, that's a lot of years to think of nothing else.
Oh, yes. Yes, a lot of... I've known quite a few biographers myself who became so obsessed with their subjects they ended up looking like them and would react as if stung if you said anything critical about their worshipped subjects. Never wanted to be like that.
Any doubt in your mind, Edmund, that Theodore Roosevelt belongs on Mount Rushmore?
No, I think he. We could have a few other faces up there, I suppose. I don't think he likes being next to Jefferson, whom he despised. But he would have been quite happy to see FDR up there beside him. But at the moment, in most historical surveys, he rates as our fourth greatest president after Lincoln, Washington, and FDR. And I think that's about historically where he belongs.
The new book by Edmund Morris is called Colonel Roosevelt. It is the third and final volume of his trilogy about the life of the president. He'll be in town to speak tomorrow at the Belo Mansion and also the Adolphus Hotel. Edmund, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.